So like I mentioned, I'm just going to work through a few questions today, and how I tend to order Q&As, and I know Caleb does the same thing too, is that we basically like to address them in the order of how they're seen in the book. The first couple questions are actually just more kind of broad picture of the whole book itself, and then I have a couple at the end that are kind of more from specific places. So the first question that I actually want to address is actually a combination of questions. I had a few different questions come in, and as I was thinking about it, I'm like, I'm just going to address all these at once in kind of a big, long answer, because it's just the easiest way to do it rather than breaking it up and basically recovering the same material over and over. So the group of questions that I am going to answer is, I'm just going to read like the whole group, and then I'll talk about it, and you'll see how I answer all of them. But the group of questions is, would the original audience have understood this book and how it is laid out? That's a really good question, because Isaiah covers a lot of different time periods. So the question is basically, well, who understood the layout of the book? And like, how does that relate to who understood the parts of the book? And like, basically, like, how did this work is the question. It's a really good question to ask. And then also with that, who slash when was the original audience? And that's a fun question to answer, because again, you have decades of ministry that are being talked about. So is that the original audience of the book as we have it, or the original audience of what Isaiah was saying? And I'll actually be answering both of them in that question. And then how do Isaiah's disciples play into this? Because we're told multiple times that he gives writings to be preserved by his disciples. And then also in this question as well, I'll be addressing the prophecy of Cyrus and how that plays into like whether or not you hold that that is a specific predictive prophecy. And why I lead into that is because another part of this question I'm going to deal with is, if you read anything about Isaiah, you're going to see very quickly that there's a lot of debate about, was it just Isaiah that wrote Isaiah, or were there multiple authors that wrote Isaiah, or did he write some of it and then his disciples wrote the rest of it? So there's a lot of debate about that. So all of those questions is what I'm addressing. So let's just begin to work through that. So again, that cluster of questions, this whole cluster is a fairly complicated group of questions to answer, and something that I honestly purposely didn't address too much throughout this series, mostly just honestly for the sake of time. And I also basically knew I was going to have to address it in the Q&A, so I basically just chose to save it till now. But if you, like I said, if you interact with any commentaries or other sources about Isaiah, what you're going to see is this is actually a really big source of debate. And it is definitely a good question to give some time. Again, I, from the beginning, knew I was going to have to address this at some point. The debates about like who wrote what part and all that stuff gets really complicated and technical, so I'm going to do my best to stay at a broad level and just not be boring, is honestly my goal with this answer, is to hopefully make it in a way that makes sense and is at least somewhat interesting. But first, there is a lot of debate, and when I say that there's a lot of debate, I don't want you to just hear there's currently a lot of debate. There has like always been a lot of debate about Isaiah. In fact, if you look at the Talmuds or the Jewish writings going back all the way to like 1 or 200 AD, even back then there was debate about was Isaiah the only author or were there multiple authors? So this isn't a new question. But there has basically always been debate about when specifically each section of Isaiah was written. And when I say each section, keep in mind last week and as I've worked through the book, I've pointed out that by and large, how the book of Isaiah is broken up is that there are three books, if you will, within the book of Isaiah. Chapters 1 through 9 are the book of the king, and I talk about how I don't necessarily like that because 1 through 5 is introduction, and then 6 is his call to ministry. So really, 7 through 39 is the call of the king, or the book of the king. But then 40 to 55 is the book of the servant, and then 56 to 66 is the book of the conqueror. So you basically have three different books, and they're broken up like that because they have different content, and you can tell that the intended audience is different. But there are basically three books that the book of Isaiah is broken up into, and like I explained in each sermon, it does seem pretty obvious that each section does seem to be and is intended to be addressed to an audience of a different time period. 1 through 9 is by and large addressed to the people of Isaiah's day. Now, with that, you need to keep in mind he ministered for a long time through the reigns of four kings, so that's his day is a broad period. But then 40 to 55 is intended and addressed to the people in exile in Babylon. And then 56 to 66 is addressed to the people who have just come back and are wondering why only some of the promises have come true. So you have three different intended audiences. And then because of this, and because of, again, grossly oversimplifying things, but because there is some seeming difference in vocabulary and writing style, and a few other issues as well, scholars tend to argue that what we have today as one book of Isaiah might have been written by three different authors or group of authors, and basically all the caveats because there's a ton of different views out there. But then also possibly by his disciples, so maybe he wrote some of it and then they continued his work. And we know his disciples, are mentioned multiple times, and I'll get back to that later. But by and large, there is a consensus that Isaiah himself wrote the first 39 chapters. It's after that is where most of the disagreement comes in. And some take this even further, and this is where it gets really technical, but some take it even further, and where they see what's called Isaiah, and then like Deutero, and then third Isaiah is like, so basically 1, 2, 3 Isaiah is the three different books. And some people, what they do is, if some people who hold that view will also say that, like, well, this part of the first book of Isaiah sounds like the second book of Isaiah, so this was actually like inserted into the first book. So they basically like divide up the three books into the sections of the three different authors, and then it gets really confusing really fast. So I'm not going to go into all that, but just know that that does happen as well. Another major reason for this debate comes in from the prophecy about Cyrus, which is another question that I wanted to address as well. And with this one, with the prophecy of Cyrus, it seems to be a predictive prophecy, like Cyrus specifically being called out like 150 years before he is even in power, that he is going to be the one to bring back Israel. So then the debate comes in about this, and a lot of times when you have any sort of specific predictive prophecy like this, by default you're going to get debate, because some people don't like that. That there is that specific predictive prophecy. Now, even that, I want to caveat real quick, even that is very oversimplifying it. Because you can look at the book of Isaiah, and you can say that the predictive prophecy of Cyrus is not a predictive prophecy, depending on when you think it was written. But even with that, nobody argues that the book of Isaiah was written after like 400 AD. So you still have chapter 53, which is a predictive prophecy about Jesus. So you can hold that Cyrus is not a predictive prophecy, but then you can't turn around and say that because they do, they don't believe in any predictive prophecy, if that makes sense. Because nobody's saying that Isaiah was written after the time of Jesus. So you still have 53, whatever your view is. And you have all the other prophecies of Isaiah as well. But again, getting back to this, if a scholar is arguing because of the predictive prophecy thing, then basically what they're going to argue is that, well, that's the name Cyrus, or like part of the prophecy in those chapters where he's mentioned, is a later insertion by a later author, or that the whole prophecy was written later. But for this Cyrus question, I want to talk about a little bit more. We have seen again and again throughout the book of Isaiah that prediction and fulfillment is one of the main proofs that Isaiah uses to prove that the Lord is the only Lord. And he does this throughout Isaiah. You see multiple times that God calls the idols to court. And what he does is basically calls them to court and said, prove yourself. And what he asks them to do to prove themselves is to give any sort of past prophecy that has come true, that they can say that they prophesied this and it happened, to give any prophecy of something that's about to come true so that we can watch and see it unfold. And then in a couple of verses, he just gets basically sarcastic. He's like, just do something, like do anything to prove that you are a God. And again in Isaiah, the point is being made that they can't because they aren't God. And because of that, this Cyrus prophecy fits right into the theme of Isaiah and what he's doing throughout the book of Isaiah. And the point being made is that the idols cannot prophesy. Only God's prophecies and promises come true, which is a major hinge point of the entire book of Isaiah. Isaiah is constantly calling the people to trust in God because he is the only one that they can actually trust. Because again and again, the people are looking to trust other nations, trust other gods, trust basically, there's a whole chapter that lists all the things they're trusting besides God. And it's like literally anything but God is what they're choosing to trust. So the whole ministry of Isaiah is, guys, trust God. He's the only one you can trust. So my first answer to the Cyrus question is that the Cyrus prophecy is, I think it's very legitimate and strong argument to understand it as a predictive prophecy because it fits right into what Isaiah is doing in his entire book, in that he is using prophecy to prove that God is the only God. And then one other thing with here too, is just kind of a side that was interesting about this whole debate, is that Cyrus is not actually the only specific person who is called out by name ahead of time. I actually didn't even know that there was another one, but King Josiah is actually called out by name before his birth. It's said in 1 Kings 13:2 that a son will be born, and then it specifically says Josiah is going to be born, and these are the things he's going to do. And then later, when he's like in the middle of them, he sees what's happening, and somebody looks at him like, "Hey, that's what was just said about you. Like, you're doing it. Good job." So I think it's cool that it's not the only one. And then lastly, in this whole discussion, the other parts about the prophecy of Cyrus in the context of chapters 44 and 45, where you see the prophecy of Cyrus, they actually support that it was not a later writing. Because something that's interesting is you have this specific name that is given, that Cyrus will be the one to do that. But then if you look in around it in the context, and not only just in 44 or 45, but some other chapters as well, the conditions that are being talked about the people in exile, and also the conditions and the circumstances of how Babylon falls, what you have by and large is basically just stereotypical prophetic language. And it's interesting because if you're going to argue that the Cyrus is a later writing, it would have been very easy for you to actually give like detailed specifics of the condition in the exile and the actual fall of Babylon. But instead you just have this like stereotypical language of like Babylon is going to fall and you are going to be in hardship. It's like you kind of have a bunch of stereotypes. Not that they're wrong, it's just that like it's just prophecies of exile, prophecies of the fall of Babylon. When if this was written much later to somebody who's looking back or looking currently at Cyrus, it would have been very easy for them to write that differently in a way that would make more sense based on the time. So I feel like it's kind of, there's an inconsistent argument going on there to say that Cyrus was a later edition, but then to also look at all the other details around it and like why weren't those changed too? So that's, to me, that's a part of the argument as well. And then also, like I said earlier, just I want to make it clear, there are arguments to be made based on the writing style and stuff. Like, you can make a decent argument that the prophecy about Cyrus, that there is some textual stuff going on there, that it could, in theory, be written as a current event thing, because if you read the text at face value and your assumption going into it is that it was written after the fact, it doesn't actually read like a prophecy. It just reads like a statement. But if you believe it was written by Isaiah beforehand, then it would be a prophecy. So I just want to point that out. Like, you can be evangelical and not believe that it is predictive prophecy, specifically because there are so many other prophecies in Isaiah that are predictive prophecy. And as long as you're not rejecting all of those, like if you're making a decent argument and you're defending it about Cyrus, like at the end of the day, as long as you're not also using strange arguments to debunk 53 and everything else, like there's really at the end of the day, there's some room for some discussion there is one thing I just wanted to point out. And then as far as the question about the different writers of the three different books of Isaiah, I'm going to grossly oversimplify things here, and also I just want to point out that is, unfortunately, if you read debates back and forth about the different authors and whether or not there was one or multiple authors, they tend to oversimplify each other's arguments and strawman each other. So I am acknowledging right now that I am oversimplifying it, but I'm also acknowledging that each side oversimplifies each other. So don't, basically just try to use good arguments and good logic when you're interacting with some of this stuff. But basically, there is a lot of... I misread my own sentence. Basically, to summarize before I get into a little bit, there is not a convincing argument to me that the books, the three books of Isaiah, have to be three different authors. I read a bunch of different arguments about how it's argued for the different authors, and none of them to me absolutely require that there are different authors and that Isaiah couldn't have done it, because there's a good explanation of how Isaiah would have done it or that he had written it or some other things that I'll get into as well. But anyways, vocabulary and stylistic differences are often pointed to in Isaiah, and even like in, there's a lot of New Testament debates, like did Paul write this book or that book and how that, what's going on there. And I really struggle to be quickly convinced by any of those, because Okay, Isaiah wrote over decades. When I write, like, if I wrote my sermon series on Isaiah next year, it would be different than this year, let alone if I wrote it decades later. So, of course, vocabulary and writing styles and the words he used and how he used them, of course, they're going to change because he had a ministry that spanned over decades. So it's a very weak argument to me to point at vocabulary and stylistic change and say, well, that has to be a different author. It's like people change how they write. And then also you need to keep in mind, again, the decades of ministry. He's also talking about different things. He's got slightly different genres happening throughout the book of Isaiah. He's got different themes that he's building and developing and changing throughout the book. So, of course, his writing is going to be different. And then also one thing that we just always forget, because we like to think that one author wrote everything, that is not how most writing works even today. Like today, somebody writes a book and then they send it to an editor who fixes all of their grammatical mistakes and tweaks it a little bit. And maybe depending on their relationship between the editor, sometimes they also have the freedom to say, I don't like how you wrote that. You should fix that and write it in a more clear way. And here's maybe a suggestion of how you should do that. So like even today, one person doesn't write most books. And that is especially true back then when writing a lot of times was team efforts. So I don't think we should discredit at all that his disciples maybe helped him or were brainstorming with him about how to do stuff. I don't think we should discredit at all that he maybe had some teamwork going on. Paul like straight up tells us in the New Testament, he's like, this person helped me and this person helped me and this person helped me. But we like to ignore that and just say it was just written by Paul. And then also one thing that we oftentimes discredit, especially in the Old Testament, is that there's the difference between the original writing and the final form. And when I say final form, I mean what we have today as the book of Isaiah or any other book. And it's very obvious throughout almost all of the Old Testament that there is some sort of editorial hand that goes on throughout the centuries until we have the final form. Especially like the books of Moses that were written very, very early. There's strong arguments to be made for those books, for the book of Isaiah here, that like, I'll just say, I would say it's very reasonable and very easy to argue, but not like, There are good arguments on both sides, but to me, you don't have to have multiple authors. There's a very good, compelling argument that just Isaiah wrote it, but you also should probably acknowledge that some editors over the years changed some stuff, because a good example in the Old Testament is like, a lot of times names are changed, or place names are changed. A lot of times grammar and words are kind of updated as the language changes, because there's a big difference in pre-exilic Hebrew and post-exilic Hebrew. Those are almost like, they're the same language, but there's a lot of changes between them, and a lot of times the wording was updated a little bit. And that's no knock against Isaiah writing it, that's just saying it was edited a little bit before we have the final form that we have. So all that to say, I just wanted to make sure that we're nuancing our arguments as well as they should be when we think about these debates, to say that there are decent arguments for multiple authors. You can hold multiple authors and be an evangelical. You should just think through it well and make sure you're not doing it in a way that's violating other things. But I would say to me, the most convincing argument is that Isaiah wrote the majority of it. He probably had a little help, just like everybody worked in teams, and there was probably some editorial stuff that happened throughout the years. But back to the original question about the original audience. So who was the original audience, and would they have understood how this book was laid out? I think it is likely best to understand that the original audience was the people of Isaiah's day for most of, if not all of, the book. Because we have to keep in mind that most of what we see in Isaiah is what he said to the people. So as far as like technically speaking, the original audience was the people around him. But then what about the book itself and how we have it now? What I would say for that is that Isaiah is... We know that in chapter 8, he gives a copy of what he's writing to his disciples to preserve for him. And then we also know in chapter 30 that the Lord calls him to preserve what he is writing for future generations. So I would say that it's very likely that this became a habit of Isaiah's, and that he, over his decades, was compiling and working on what we now know as the book of Isaiah. And that likely what we have as the form of it that we do was probably done sometime near the end of his life. And that as far as like the book itself, the original audience of that, I guess, would have been probably his disciples. Because by the time you get to the end of his life, the king after Hezekiah killed Isaiah. He wasn't really popular at all. So nobody besides his disciples may have been reading his writings at that point. But then he also felt very compelled and commissioned his disciples to preserve his word for the future. So I think in a way, if you want to think about the book itself of Isaiah, it's very likely the intended audience was his disciples to preserve it for future generations. And that because of that, in 40 to 66, when you have him prophetically speaking through the eyes of the Lord to future generations, he's doing this knowing that he is being rejected in his time. And he is purposely writing for future generations. So I think that's really cool, if you just think about the dynamics of how the book was written. So I know that that all is kind of a drawn-out answer, but I just wanted to show there is some complexity there. But to me, there's a very compelling argument that Isaiah wrote it, and I think it's very cool to think about the timeline of how he wrote it as well. So that is the first cluster of questions. And then the next question I want to address is a question I got a few times, especially at the beginning. Why did you go through Isaiah so quickly? And I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek because it was like 15 weeks, but it's also 66 books or 66 chapters. So as far as a book of this length, 15 weeks was very quick to go through Isaiah, and I know that. The first part of this question or this answer is that logistically I had to be done by Easter because that's the preaching schedule that Caleb and I chose on, and that's also like our workflow schedule. I have to be done by Easter because work gets very busy for me, and I have like I don't have enough free time to be sermon prepping after Easter. So I had to be done by Easter, so that's a part of the decision, obviously. But even with that, as I was prepping to do Isaiah, I was considering splitting it up between chapters 1 and 39 and then 40 to 66. To me, that got a bit into the whole who wrote Isaiah and how you present it type thing, and I like the idea of presenting it all at once to reinforce that it was written by Isaiah. And then I also like that presenting it all at once allowed us to more clearly get the flow of the whole book, because that's, I feel like, what most of us, myself included, really struggled with getting into the book, is that how are all these parts connected to each other? So I purposely chose to do it all at once, even though I knew that that was going to mean that we went through it quickly. Another part of that gets to logistics, in that I know that the next time we would have looked at 40 to 66 at the earliest would have been this next winter. So we all would have slept a lot of times between the first half and the second half of Isaiah, and I would have had to basically rehearse the whole first part of it. So there's a few logistics there, but also to me, the strength of presenting it all at once, especially the first time we go through it as a church, that we can have a good grasp of the flow of the book. And then also with that, the question of what would be most helpful was actually my driving force of how I structured all of my sermons and how I structured the sermon series itself, and also how I divided up the book. This is a very big book, but it also is a very important book. It's a book that also includes a lot of different genres and a lot of different writing styles and prophecies and oracles and woes and lots of stuff going on in Isaiah. And almost the universal feedback that I received as I was preparing for this series was that other people, and honestly myself included, my own feedback about my own grasping of the book, was that we struggle to understand the flow and structure of the book and how all the individual parts fit within the whole. Because Isaiah is a beautiful book. We all have like verses or sections that we are either have memorized or are very familiar with. But the question is, okay, where does this one part that I know fit within the overall flow of the book? And then how does that work when the New Testament brings it in? And I don't feel like I understand the original context enough, well enough, to actually understand what the New Testament is doing with it. So I wanted to make sure that we understood the structure and flow, and I really tried to emphasize that as we were going, so that we would know where and how the pieces that we know and love fit in the flow of the whole. And then with that discussion, for example, nobody was excited about the oracles and the woes, myself included. But what I've also come to realize, and what I tried to also really show when I went through Exodus and Leviticus, is that the parts of the Bible that are boring, seem weird, seem repetitive and random, those are often way more important than we give them credit for. And just like logistically speaking, as far as looking at the Bible as an ancient book, you would not have put the work of writing and preserving all of this stuff if it was not unnecessary. Writing and preserving was not an easy task when the Bible was written. And you're not going to have chapters 13 all the way to chapter 35 for no reason at all. So I wanted us to make sure we slowed down and understood it. And starting with myself, what is going on with this book, with the whole middle section of this book that we tend to just skip in our Bible reading? I wanted to make sure we didn't skip it and that we understood how it fit in the flow. And to keep the flow of the book front and center, I also preached it section by section. Isaiah, like I said, contains narrative, poetry, prophecy, oracles, and woes. This is not an epistle. And because of that, it is oftentimes best, especially the first time that you're grappling with it, to read it and grapple with it section by section. Because that type of literature is meant to be read as a section. And if you don't understand it as a section, as a complete literary unit, you are going to misunderstand the smaller parts of the literary unit. So I chose to preach Isaiah literary unit by literary unit. And that also helped us to see how they flowed and built on each other without getting lost in the weeds of taking multiple weeks in one literary unit just to see how that literary unit is flowing in the flow of the whole book of Isaiah. So basically, I was trying to help us to see the forest and not get lost looking at an individual tree. And I'm aware that that meant I went through the book fairly quickly. So in summary, I chose to preach in a way that focused on equipping us to understand the book as a whole and to be able to dig in more deeply on our own. My goal and hope was that my preaching lit a fire in you to study Isaiah. And even more, just as importantly, helped you to see that you can, that it is a book that you can grasp. There is a flow to it. It is not just random, all these different genres just thrown together, all these prophecies just thrown together. There is a build and a story in Isaiah. So I wanted to encourage you to have a passion for Isaiah and then feel like you can actually put some feet to that passion and look at the book in a way that you actually understand it. And I am aware that because of all this, because of this really big drive for equipping and understanding of the structure, I'm aware that my sermons oftentimes sounded a bit more like lectures than sermons. But this again is because one of my main goals is always to give you the tools that you need to keep studying on your own. I don't want you to rely on what Caleb and I say from the pulpit once a week. Because that's, I mean, it's a good place to start, but your soul needs more. And we always want to equip you to do more throughout the week. And this passion to equip leads perfectly into my next question that I wanted to answer, which, because I've mentioned so many times throughout the series that I'm trying to equip you to do more, a question that I got is, what are some resources that you would suggest to do more, to be digging into it more? And also, what resources did you use? So rather than bore you with a list of a bibliography, there we go, of the resources that I used, I am going to attach my bibliography to the recording of this week, so I'm not going to work through that right now, but I am going to attach it, and I have it divided up by source type, so like my commentaries I used, my biblical dictionaries I used, my atlas that I used, study Bibles, lexicons, stuff like that. It's all divided by type, so that you kind of know what I was working with when I worked through it. And then one thing I also did is that last week's recording, I don't know how many of you have noticed, but there are two attachments to last week's recording. There is the PowerPoint, which is all the charts and the outlines of the whole book of Isaiah. The other attachment is actually my entire manuscript, because I do manuscript everything that I say from up here. I don't always actually stay on the manuscript. A lot of times I kind of go off my own things. But all 91 pages of my manuscript for the entire book of Isaiah are attached to last week's recording as a PDF. So I wanted to make those available for future study. And by the way, with the manuscript, be gracious to it. I didn't have time to go and perfectly polish everything. So you will notice some like typos and things like that. So just be kind. And then also with that, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about resources in general. And before I do that, I want to point out, like, the reason I brought this book up here is I realized I'd had this one at home. I did use it a little bit throughout Isaiah. But what this is, it's Zondervan Charts. It's Chronological and Background Charts of the Old Testament by John Walton. And it is an awesome resource. I'm going to put it back in the library afterwards today. So if multiple people want to get it, maybe like flip to the pages you want and take pictures of it so that you don't have to wait for each other. But use it however you want. And that's also why, by the way, Caleb and myself, like, pretty much my philosophy is if I'm done with a personal, with a Bible study book that I have, there's no reason for me to have it still at my house. So I put it back in the library back there. I try to make as many resources as I can available to you guys. And speaking of that, as far as interacting with resources in general, one thing I always like to say as you're interacting with any resources, is that commentaries, dictionaries, encyclopedias, lexicons, study Bibles, atlases, articles, especially anything online, or anything, honestly, that I say, it, shocker, is written by a person. It is not infallible. So never have just one person as your resource. That is why my bibliography is like almost 2 pages long. I do not like taking just one person's word for something about what the text is saying. So if you can at all, interact with multiple people. And then also be gracious to the people that you are interacting with. We like to just slam, like, well, you obviously missed this, or like, how on earth are you this far off field? We are all doing the best with the information that we can. So be gracious to people that you are interacting with. But we all have blind spots. We all miss things. We all overemphasize things that shouldn't have been emphasized as much, or underemphasize things that should have been emphasized more. We are all missing information. We're all maybe presenting something in one way that could also be presented in another way. So again, just don't take the word of just one person, and be gracious to the people that you are interacting with, and just know that like what they are trying to be is a guide. And by the way, with that, if they are presenting themselves as the right answer about everything, you should, I would say just stop listening to them, but like they probably still have some good stuff to say, but just know that they are completely wrong about that. They do not have all the answers. Nobody does. Only God does. So with that, just keep that in mind as you're working with sources, and also grapple with and pray the text yourself. What I would do as I'm studying through this text, I would get kind of muddled in my head as I read about a bunch of different people, and then I would just close my Bible software thing and just think about the text myself and pray about it and see where the Holy Spirit was leading me about whose argumentation was better or what seems to be the main point of the text going on. So never neglect the role of the Holy Spirit in your own Bible study. We are told, though, that we are to study in community. And one of my favorite things to say about books is that a book is just a person talking to you on paper. So you should talk to other people as well. And the books that you interact with are people that are basically talking to you. Their words have just been written down. But keep that in mind. Like the Holy Spirit never should be neglected. But also we know from Scripture, from multiple places, that the Holy Spirit tends to work in community. So it's both and. I want to segue now from these questions to a couple other questions. The questions up until this point have basically been overview questions. So with the remaining time today, I want to look at a couple questions that are a bit more specific to the text itself. The first one is, are people who are deceived by false teachers still saved by their faith? And this sounds like a broad question, but it comes from a couple different specific places in Isaiah. And it's something that I spent just a brief amount of time on a sermon, but wanted to look into a bit more deeply. So this question comes from a few different places, but especially chapter 3, verse 12. And if you want to turn to this one, it comes especially from chapter 9, verse 13 through 21 of Isaiah. So that's 9, 13 to 21. I'm not going to read them, but you can look at them while I'm talking. But in Isaiah, the leaders and teachers of Judah and Israel, in other chapters as well, they are repeatedly scolded by God and held accountable for how they have misled the people. But what about the people? Isaiah 9:17, in that verse, God says that he will not even have compassion on the fatherless and the widows, which is interesting because almost everywhere else in the Bible, you read that God has great compassion and fights for the fatherless and the widows. It's one of the only verses in the Bible that God actually is condemning them. So then, especially in light of this verse, is there no grace for those who have been deceived and led astray by false teachers? First, we need to look at the context of Isaiah 9:17. And like I just said, we have to realize it is one of the only places in the Bible that God is specifically attacking even the ones who are framed as helpless and being deceived. But in 9:13 to 21, the Lord walks through how every single class of society has turned away from him and rebelled. Yes, the leaders have led the people astray, but the people themselves have chosen to rebel against the Lord and have become full of godlessness, evil deeds, and complete lack of love. There are a bunch of adjectives, quite strong adjectives, that are used about every class of society in that whole text there. God is holding the people accountable then for their choices and actions, and they have turned away from him at every level of society, is what is being told in that section there. Throughout the Bible, and even many times elsewhere in Isaiah, we read that God defends, fights for, and gives grace to the poor and the needy who are being mistreated, oppressed, or deceived. But part of the case being built here in chapter 9 and elsewhere in Isaiah is that the exile is coming because the people as a whole have rejected him. He uses the illustration, I can't remember what chapter, but he's like, the whole body is sick. It starts with the head, yes, but he walks through every part of the body and says the whole body is diseased, and that is why the exile is coming. But even with this, we have to realize that, well, Isaiah. Like, Isaiah is obviously an exception, because he is not completely in rebellion against God. We're also told he has a group of disciples who are not in rebellion against God. And then I also have to believe that at least somebody listened to him in some way, at least during his decades of ministry. I don't think it was a complete universal rejection, but it was a by and large rejection, which he had been told ahead of time was going to happen. So, by and large, just as he had been told in chapter 6, his message fell on deaf ears. God is a gracious and a loving God who is slow to anger, but he also gives judgment when grace is exhausted. And you see this in chapter 5, in the parable of the vineyard, that God had put all of his tender care and mercy into the vineyard. He had planted it, he had helped it grow, and he had defended it. And then when he looked to the fruit, it was wild, or the word there is useless, inedible grapes. The people had borne a fruit the opposite of all the loving care that God had put into them. And because of that complete rejection of complete grace, that is when the exile came. We see throughout Scripture, Old and New Testament, that some of God's most scathing words are given to false teachers who are misleading the people. There's a whole chapter from Jesus to the Pharisees about this, for a New Testament example as well. We see that false teachers, starting at the teacher level, we see that teachers, specifically, are held to a higher level of accountability and judgment. We see this in James 3 verse 1. We see that it is a caution to teachers before putting themselves in that position, just to realize that you are held accountable for your teaching and how it impacts the people that you are teaching. And then we also see in Jesus' word to the Pharisees, in God's words to the leaders here in Isaiah and so many other places, that false teachers are held accountable for how they have misused and abused their position. We also see examples, many examples of God's grace and compassion for those who have been abused and misled by these false teachers. Think of just Jesus' compassion and love and how he cries for the crowds. He has a deep compassion for those who are being misled. In his words, though, to the Pharisee, Jesus also says that the Pharisees were shutting the very door of heaven, the kingdom of heaven, in the face of their followers, and that neither they nor their followers would enter. So we do know that God does have grace and compassion for those who are being misled, but we also know from Jesus' own words that they can be misled, and because of their following of this false leader, that the door to the kingdom of heaven is closed to them, because their leader, who is supposed to be leading them there, has slammed it in their face. So this is a tough question, and this is ultimately not a question that I can answer for each individual and each group. I am not God. I cannot tell you by a specific false teacher or a specific individual what that means for their eternal fate. Only God has that answer. But I think the key to how we think about this question is the word faith. Do those being deceived have faith? And if so, what is their faith ultimately in? In Isaiah 9, they did not have faith. The people, every level of society, are rejected and scorned by God and judged by God because they completely have turned away from God. They are judged for their rebellion and their pride and their lack of faith and trust in God. They had completely turned away from him. We know that faith is what saves us. It is a faith that is a loving loyalty to God, living in obedience to him as best as we can, and repenting when we fail or learn that we have been taught incorrectly. But the key is faith. The key is always faith. The answer also depends on what we mean by false teachers, especially as we bring this question forward to today. Because too often other denominations are classified as false teachers, and then we question the eternal fate of those who are listening. And I think this is dangerous grounds really quickly, because a lot of denominations preach at the core of the same gospel. And where the disagreements are on things that do not matter for eternal fate. They are things that could, at times, be very important, but as long as the core of the gospel and how one is saved, how one is made right with God, that is the core of the question. There's room for disagreement on other things. In the epistles, Paul and the other writers leave a lot of room for different opinions. But where they don't leave room is on the gospel itself and how one is made right with God. That is where you have them take very strong stances. They leave a lot of room for disagreement on other things. So I think as we think through this question, we have to keep the core, the gospel, center in how we're thinking through this. And that is really the most that I can say about this question, because I cannot answer this for every individual or every situation that you were thinking of. The next and the last question I want to address is, can you explain more about Isaiah 14 and Lucifer? Back in Isaiah 14, you can turn there. Back in Isaiah 14, I talked about how that chapter and Ezekiel 28 have caused many questions about whether or not they are talking about the fall of the devil. Something I didn't mention at the time is that Isaiah 14, at least in the KJV, is also where we get the word Lucifer, which is where we also get that association with Lucifer and the devil. Because of those questions about, does Isaiah 14 talk about the fall of the devil? The KJV uses the name Lucifer near the beginning of the text. So that's where you get that association. And I know I said Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. I've been studying Isaiah, not Ezekiel, so I'm not addressing Ezekiel 28 today. I'm sorry. I didn't have time to look into that because I would need to feel like I have my feet under me for the whole book of Isaiah first before I confidently from the pulpit here give an answer about that one. But as far as Lucifer goes, Lucifer is simply the Latin word for shining one or morning star or the planet Venus, and it is used to translate the Hebrew word halel, which also means shining one, morning star, or the planet Venus. This language would immediately have brought to mind for the original reader a pagan god, and it's actually being used on purpose that way. Because as I talked about in my sermon on Isaiah 14, there are known myths or mythological stories about the gods, especially Canaanite, that line up very well with the wording used in Isaiah 14. And so these myths, not the fall of the devil, I think are where we should be looking for comparisons. To the best that I understand it, by the way, the most likely myth being referred to by Isaiah 14 is the myth of Athtar, which his name also means shining one, just like the Hebrew word halel means shining one. So that's why the Hebrew word there is used to, in relation to the word for Athtar. But in the mythological story, the Canaanite story, after the god Baal died, which I don't remember how that happens, but after Baal died, Athtar was voted to try to take Baal's place. So he went up to the heights of Zaphon, which if you look at the end of Isaiah 14:13, most of your Bible is going to have a little number there, depending on how many numbers have come before it. I can't tell you what number it is, but you're going to see that the alternate text is the remote parts of Zaphon. Zaphon is a mountain north of Israel in the region of Syria. It was a mountain very steeped in theological understanding, and it was thought to be the seat of the Canaanite gods. So when he's climbing up to the mounts of Zaphon, he is climbing up to the seat of the Canaanite gods. And what he does when he gets there is he tries to sit in Baal's seat. And when he sits down, he realizes that his feet don't reach the footstool, and his head doesn't reach the top. So he sits down, and in the Canaanite story, to his credit, he immediately is like, yeah, this isn't my job. So he gets off, and then he is then voted instead to be the king of the underworld. So what's interesting is the seeds of this story actually align almost perfectly with what's happening in Isaiah 14. It's just painted in a little bit different light. In Isaiah 14, the king of Babylon, through the language of this myth, is being mocked for his arrogance and pride that he thinks himself to be of divine origin and able to sit on the seat of the Most High. Now, what's interesting is the wording there, Isaiah 14:14, says Most High. This God is actually higher than Baal, because this is Elion, the God, the high God of the Canaanite religion. So he's actually like taking it a step further than Athtar. But the Lord, the real Most High, we read in Isaiah 14, will cast him down for his pride to the underworld. Not to rule it, like Athtar, who was voted to rule the underworld, but to be cast down there and humiliated, is what will happen to the king of Babylon. So I think what's going on, and the best way to understand what's happening in Isaiah 14, is that Canaanite mythological language is being used as a parable, if you will, of his pride. And because of all the connections to known Canaanite myths, I don't think this is a good place to look for the origin story of the devil and his fall. I think that there's too much known Canaanite mythology here, but I think that Ezekiel 28 would probably be the better place to look. Ezekiel 28, 1 through 10 is similar to Isaiah 14, uses a lot of known Canaanite language, so that one's pretty obvious Canaanite. But then Ezekiel 28, 11 through 19 refers to the Garden of Eden and uses a lot of Genesis 1 through 3 imagery. So I think that is the best place to look for connections to the fall of the devil. But again, I didn't preach through Ezekiel, so I'm just going to leave that there. I would love one day, by the way, to do a sermon series through Ezekiel. So I'll just leave that teaser out there. I don't know when that's going to happen, though, but I would really enjoy that. But the most important takeaway, and as I close things up here, the most important takeaway from this last question is that in both passages, Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, what the point that is being made by Isaiah and Ezekiel is that God is Lord over all. And if you miss that point with trying to dig into, well, what's being said about the devil and this, what's being said about his fall and what do these gems mean and all this stuff, like, if you miss the point of what's being said, then you've really got distracted with something that's of secondary value from the text. The point being made is that God is Lord over all, both human kings and empires and divine enemies as well. No one can usurp God's position as most high. Nobody else equates to God. Nobody is most high except God, is the point being made. And especially in the context of Isaiah, the main point is that God alone is worthy of faith and trust. Because in Isaiah 14, it is a crumpling and the downfall of the king of Babylon to make the point that the people should not be looking to the strength of Babylon for their deliverance. Because the people of Israel and Judah have been tempted to go towards the Babylonian leaders and their gods, because obviously they're the most powerful. They exiled us, and they seem to have the power in the world. And the point being made is, no, they don't. God has, does, always will have the true power in the world. He is the Most High, and He alone. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this book. I thank you for even some of these more technical questions here at the end as we think through and try to make sure that we're a bit nuanced in our own understanding of the book and some of the debates that go into it. I just thank you so much for the time that we've had to grapple with this book. I thank you for the consistent theme and message of this book, that you are Lord over all. You are worthy of our trust. You have shown that again and again and again, whether or not we admit it. And I also just praise you that you, as you showed through the developing story of Isaiah, that you not only give these grand promises, but your plan is accomplished to bring them about. And I pray that as we go from today, that we would live in faith in you and in trust in you, knowing that you are the only one worthy of our trust. And I pray all this in your name. Amen.